The continuing punitive military operations in Ukraine bring to question how far a government can go to squash dissent. The Western-backed government, in the eyes of many, has been guilty of horrible crimes from Mariupol to Odessa, and there have been accusations of war crimes as heavy artillery, white phosphorus, and cluster bombs are being used in Slavyansk, Lugansk, and other areas. We spoke to Charles Shoebridge, a former military intelligence counterterrorism specialist, regarding the punitive operation Ukraine is waging against its own people.
VR exclusive.
This is John Robles. I'm speaking with Mr. Charles Shoebridge. He's a former British Army officer and counterterrorism intelligence officer. He's also a security analyst and specialist. Hello, sir. How are you this evening?
Yeah, good to hear from you. Fine, thanks.
Regarding the escalating situation in the southeast of Ukraine, the latest developments, we have incursions into Russian territory. We have what's probably the use of white phosphorus. We have cluster bombs being used. Can you comment on the military aspect of the operation there against the opposition?
Yes, I mean, what the Ukraine government appears to be doing is employing tactics that are traditionally used by armies throughout the world that don't have really a coherent counter-insurgency strategy. I mean, they are calling this a counter-terrorism operation, but in fact, it's increasingly looking like, from the side of the Ukraine military's perspective, a conventional assault on towns using heavy weapons and the array of weaponry, or should we say at least the means being used in terms of, for example, the alleged and the suspected use of white phosphorus recently, is an example of where the array of weaponry and means is being expanded, because of course the counterinsurgency operation that they're employing at the current time isn't working, or perhaps isn't working fast enough for the authorities in Kiev. If you remember that Poroshenko, really within hours of being elected, pretty much said that the anti-terrorist operation, as you called it, in the east would continue, but it would be over within hours. Mm-hmm. And of course those hours have now become very extended, and so therefore there's probably some political pressure, some considerable political pressure on the military to achieve whatever objectives have been set for it, even if those are going to end up to be quite limited objectives, in a fairly short space of time. And the way that the military will traditionally respond to such pressure is, of course, to ramp up the amount of firepower they're using. They are using these standard conventional tactics to a large degree because it saves their manpower in terms of being able to use heavy weapons such as strike aircraft, helicopters, artillery, mortars, and so on. Of course, all of these are weapons that can be deployed against activists or against rebels' forces with minimal risk to the actual Ukraine forces. And so you can see there that on the one hand, they want to avoid their own casualties, which of course is understandable. Secondly, though, there may be questions from the first stages of this counterterrorism operation, as it's called, a few weeks or months ago even now, where the reliability of the troops being used, the police being used in that operation, was called into question. Some of those troops even, of course, and their police even, of course, defected to the rebel side. And so again, it avoids issues like this. It avoids close combat if the Ukrainian military are using these heavy weapons.
VR exclusive.
Of course, it's fairly obvious that the majority of casualties are likely to be civilians. And then, of course, crucially, this has a very counterproductive effect, because going back to what Poroshenko said in really the early hours of him being president-elect following the elections, he, in many ways, put out an olive branch to not the fighters, but the people, as he called it, the ordinary peaceful people of the eastern provinces, that they should be part of Ukraine. They had nothing to fear. But, of course, it's those very people that now are suffering most from this strategy or these tactics of using heavy weaponry as a means of, if you like, trying to strike at the fighters, but without closing with them. The effect on the civilian population of being placed under bombardment by heavy weapons will be to turn that population against that government, irrespective of what nature of government that is.
Yeah. Let's take it a little bit into the UK. Say Scotland had a referendum they wanted to separate, right? And what if the UK government started bombing Scotland into oblivion?
For example, when the Crimean plebiscite referendum was called, the UK was in the forefront of condemning this referendum as what it called illegal. Mm-hmm. And it supported the Ukrainian government in its definition of that referendum as illegal. Notwithstanding, in September, we will be having a very similar referendum in Scotland to decide whether Scotland should become completely independent from the rest of the UK. And, of course, what makes that legal is, of course, that the UK government has agreed to that. that. And so, on the other hand, then, we've got the same government supporting a Ukraine government which doesn't allow such self-determination in the Crimea. So, right from the very start, the position of the UK and, indeed, other countries that would have supported referendums, for example, in Kosovo, notably, these countries, of course, were put from the very outset in a logically inconsistent and really unsustainable position when it came to condemning particularly the Crimea referendum. Let's say, for example, the Crimean government, as it was, invited in, for example, the OSCE to send monitors in to observe that. So, of course, then when the Western media criticizes the outcome of the Crimean referendum and points out that there were no foreign observers, at least from the West, of course, it was the West's choice not to send observers to that. They were invited. The parallel with Scotland in the UK is clear. So even if it's an adverse relationship, so you've got the UK government and its allies absolutely supporting within the UK the right of part of the UK, if it should choose to do so in September, to become independent, and yet, of course, denying that in Ukraine.
VR exclusive.
Just a reminder, you're listening to an interview with Charles Shoebridge.
Observers are deployed throughout Ukraine and particularly in the eastern province to observe what's happening in a military perspective. And it's in this context, if you like, that allegations of bombardments, including with, for example, white phosphorus, of civilian areas is a subject that ought to be the subject of some form of investigation. And the OSCE can step into this role in order to at least establish the facts of what happened. So when we go back to the situation of white phosphorus being suspected of being used near to Slavyansk in the last couple of days, I myself have seen video which purports to be, and as far as we know is, video of the target area in daylight showing what appears to be white phosphorus still in fact burning. Now, the easy part, if you like, of that investigation would be to establish that white phosphorus or something similar was used. The difficult part, of course, would be, and again, probably the OSCE and other organizations perhaps would want to take a backward step at this point. The point is then establishing what the purpose of using those munitions was, and that would then determine whether their use was illegal under the laws of war or not.
Can you give us an example of when they would be legal?
Yeah, for example, the uses of white phosphorus are basically threefold. White phosphorus can be used mainly for producing smoke to cover the movement of troops, for example, but remember that this was a nighttime incident, which makes it unlikely that smoke was the reason. Another reason that white phosphorus can be used is as a battlefield illumination device. And again, it may be that in the circumstances of its alleged use a couple of days ago, that was the case. However, there are much better ways of illuminating the battlefield, for example, by using technology, image intensification, for example. Or if you're going to use flares, there are better ones available that come down, for example, on slow parachutes, which means that the area is illuminated for much longer. So generally speaking, looking at the video from the other day, if indeed that is genuine video, and there's nothing, as far as I'm aware, to suggest that it isn't so far, that it seems unlikely, first of all, it was used for smoke. And then secondly, its use as an illuminant is dubious because, of course, there are much better ways of doing so. But it cannot be used lawfully under a number of conventions and laws, of course, in a way that is so reckless that it is going to cause obvious danger, and even less, of course, deliberately targeting civilian areas. And if indeed that was the case the other day, then it would appear there is at least a case to be made that an illegal act occurred. But again, this would require more investigation. And this is one of these areas where the OSCE, in at least establishing the facts on the ground, could be called upon to step in.
Is it legal, are these fragmentation-type bombs? Because I had a source come from Slavyansk yesterday, and he brought some pieces of a bomb that was about 2 centimeters thick steel. He says, are those legal? Or?
Yeah, I mean, many weapons are, especially anti-personnel weapons, are fragmentation devices. Even a hand grenade, for example, is a fragmentation weapon. And then, of course, that can go all the way up to artillery and to bombs shot from aircraft, which, of course, will use shrapnel to kill people. So these weapons themselves are not in themselves illegal. If cluster munitions are being used, which is a different thing, where they're using a bomb will fragment into lots of different separate bomblets, which can explode at different times, that raises issues of legality, but I don't think that's what's being discussed here at this time. However, what's important is, in a way, the type of weapon, generally speaking. What's important is how they're used. So no matter what the weapon, if it's being used indiscriminately against primarily civilian areas, and even more so if it's being used, of course, deliberately in a way that's targeting civilian areas, notwithstanding that there may be one or two fighters somewhere in that area, this could well be illegal under the rules of war. It could be said to constitute war crimes. And, of course, people can be held responsible for that at a later stage.
Is there supposed to be some level of threat that justifies a level of force. Now, I don't see a justifiable, legitimate reason to use fighter aircraft against opposition demonstrators who are defending their own areas.
It's an interesting question, not least because of this reason, that when you have a conflict between states, of course, international laws of war will apply. Here, we've got a domestic national dispute. So it raises questions, is this a war? Is this a police operation? Is this a counterinsurgency operation? Is it, as it's been described, an anti-terrorist operation? If it's an anti-terrorist operation, then I know really very little about domestic laws of Ukraine in connection with the use of force by police and so on. But, for example, most countries will have rules that apply to the application of force by the state within the state's boundaries. So if this is a policing action, then generally speaking, certainly in much of the Western world, and let's not forget it's the Western world which is largely backing this operation by the Ukraine government, then by their own standards, the deployment of force must be reasonable and it must be proportionate to the threat faced and to what the objective is actually to be achieved. But perhaps on a more important level, should we say, from the perspective of the Ukraine government, one has to ask what the objectives actually are in this case, because if the objectives are to crush the rebellion, win back the support or at least the acceptance of the people in these areas, as Poroshenko, at least on the surface, claims to be the aim that he has in mind. These methods of using heavy weapons in this way, which by their very nature tend to be poorly targeted, indiscriminatory, will be counterproductive. It's absolutely clear that if a government uses these kinds of methods of bombardment, of air attacks, of, shall we say, blockade, and of even by its speech alienating large numbers of its people. For example, straight after Yanukovych was overthrown, of course, there was a lot of draft legislation, at least, that really quite clearly was targeting the Russian-speaking population. Now, if all of that happens, of course, that is going to change the dynamic, change the mindset of people in those areas. Yeah. So that actually people who, until relatively recently, wanted themselves to be regarded as Russian-speaking and wanted their culture, language and church respected, actually, in many cases now, I'm sure, because it would happen anywhere in the world where this is happening, will actually begin to think of themselves as not being a part and not in the future a part of this state called Ukraine, which has, in their mind, in many cases, targeted them.
VR exclusive.
There needs to be peace and stability. And until there is some negotiated agreement between those in power in the eastern provinces, I'm talking about de facto power, and the government in Kiev, until some sort of stability and peace can result, the military campaign that the Ukraine government is currently waging in these provinces is almost certain to be counterproductive and will not produce an atmosphere that's conducive to a fair and free election. And it may be that even in parliamentary elections, that they can't be held in these restive provinces. But at the moment, the tactics being used by the Ukraine authorities would not be considered by most people to be good, progressive counterinsurgency tactics that are likely to produce the result that Poroshenko himself, in his election day address, said was his aim.
Last point here, would you characterize those operations there as genocide? Or
I think what's happened is that you've got a situation where the Ukraine government is struggling militarily, where you've got people who quite clearly enjoy a considerable amount of local popular support. We're talking about the rebels that here in the Western media we call separatists, but whom to a large extent they are just people who want to protect their rights from what they see as an alien government and an elected government. But the Ukraine government is finding it difficult militarily to dislodge those people. And so therefore it's resorting to the use of heavy weapons, which is going to kill and injure very large numbers of civilians as well. Mm. And of course that will just actually feed people into a feeling that they're not part of this Ukraine government or part of the Ukraine nation. And secondly, that they will actually, in many cases, sign up to defend militarily their areas from the people that are causing these deaths and this devastation. And also, of course, increasingly, it's possible now to see what the BBC and the Times and CNN are not showing, which, of course, is that there is going to be some considerable embarrassment, I think, that is growing for the Kiev government, but more importantly, perhaps in the long run, for its EU and US backers, that these US and EU backers, the government and the media here, will increasingly want to distance themselves from the Kiev government, at least publicly, the more civilian casualties are unavoidably seen. In the old days, before the internet, it would have been possible to have hidden what's going on in these provinces, the eastern provinces. But now, because of these alternative media sources available, Twitter and so on, for example, when Mariupol happened or when Odessa happened, no matter what slant the Western media put on those events, it couldn't really hide the truth behind what actually happened.
Okay. Thank you very much, Mr. Shoebridge. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, okay.
VR exclusive.
You are listening to an interview with Charles Shoebridge, a security analyst and former UK Army and counterterrorism intelligence officer.